The Spitfire's an astonishing aircraft. All through the Battle of Britain, it went head-to-head with the very best that the German Air Force flew over British shores.
I'm looking around now. I can hear machine gun fire, but I can't see our Spitfires. Oh, here's one coming down now. Somebody's hit a German, and he's coming down. There's a long streak. He's coming down completely out of control, a long streak of smoke, and he's going slap into the sea, and there he goes, smash!
But Germany's brilliant military engineers were ready to respond. I'm Tuppence Middleton, and this is Spitfire, the people's plane.
The Focke-Wulf 190 came as a horrendous shock to the British Air Ministry because of the fact that for the very first time, confidence was starting to be lost in the Spitfire because it simply just couldn't compete.
The birds fly a lot better than we do. See how they wheel and bank and fly? Perfect. And all in one. Wings, body, tail, all in one.
If Britain and the Allies are to win the Second World War, the Spitfire has to fly faster and higher than ever before. September 1940. Smoke rises from the bombed shell of the Spitfire factory in Southampton on England's south coast. An ingenious plan is put into action, moving production away from the vulnerable city centre, a magnet for German bombers, to small towns and villages. Within weeks, brand new Spitfires take to the skies. But more of the same isn't good enough. Victoria Taylor is an historian at the University of Hull. She's an expert on the Luftwaffe.
It really was trying to be able to construct a fighter that could perform at all altitudes, that could match the Spitfire's agility and its speed, and ultimately packing more of a punch than the ME-109s had against the Spitfires in the Battle of Britain. And so the Focke-Wulf 190 was seen as this incredible improvement because of the fact that once it was eventually brought in, it was around 25 to 30 miles per hour faster than the Spitfire Mark V, and also having a better cockpit for visibility, and that it had an increased boost in which it could get that sort of additional power when it needed it.
The Spitfire has to be improved fast. The design department at Supermarine is well aware that the Germans are improving their existing fighters and designing new planes, but they're in desperate straits. Their offices suffered direct hits in the September bombings of the Southampton factory. They were moved out to the local university, but within weeks, the Luftwaffe had launched a bombing blitz on the city. Hundreds of civilians died, and an incendiary bomb narrowly missed the new drawing office. If they're going to improve the Spitfire, the design team has to get out of Southampton. As their city burns, hundreds of engineers, draftsmen and women, craftsmen and designers move 10 miles north to a very different world.
So the actual core of the house is still is from the 18th century. So it's a Georgian house, quite traditional style, Queen Anne style.
This is Hursley House. A classic English stately home, an 18th century mansion set in beautiful rolling parkland. It's the home of Lady Mary Cooper.
We're standing in the conservatory, very bright, very airy. Next to us through the doorway was the ballroom and then the withdrawing room of the drawing room.
Dave Key is the historian at Hursley Park.
All of those rooms, that entire east wing and this conservatory, were taken over by the design team, the drawing office. So where we're standing, it looks quite pleasant now, but it would have been crammed full of drawing boards.
Lady Cooper was a patriotic sort. She welcomed the team from Supermarine with an enormous floral display, a model Spitfire made out of chrysanthemums. If her home has to be requisitioned for the war effort, then so be it. But this muddy-booted invasion is sometimes just too much.
One of the things about an Edwardian house, or any actually stately home, is you have parts of the house that are for the family and guests, and parts of the house which are servants. So just here, we have a grand staircase designed for Lady Cooper and her family and guests. To the side of us, we have a doorway which leads to another staircase, which is for the staff. With Supermarine, they were using all the staircase, and they were chatting on the stairs. And this is particularly Lady Cooper found difficult to cope with, the fact that you had these basically working class people loitering on her staircase. A big culture shock for her.
For chief designer Joe Smith, Hursley Park is the perfect spot. Plenty of space for his design team, extensive grounds and outbuildings to build prototype aircraft, and my goodness, there's that delicious view.
Lots of large mirrors and very, very bright light. And if you look out of the window here looking south, it's pretty much an uninterrupted view right the way through to the Isle of Wight.
There's just one nagging irritation for Smith. Lady Cooper and her servants can't seem to grasp that Hursley is no longer hers. The butler would stroll through top secret meetings on his way to the pantry, and her son proved to be a bit of a menace after a few bottles of beer.
Above, the staircase just to our side goes to the roof, and that's where the fire watch was. Lady Cooper's younger son, Alastair, was living here as well. He was an enthusiastic social drinker, and when the fire watch team were on the roof, he had a tendency to go up there with a load of beers and join them, which got a lot of very happy firewatch team, because it's pretty boring being on top of a roof in the middle of nowhere. All you can do is watch your own city get burned in the background. But not very good if you really are in charge of the safety of the site.
Something has to be done. Lady Cooper and Alistair must be removed. The perfect opportunity soon presents itself.
The butler hired a casual labourer to come in and be an assistant cook. They decided that a far better job would be to take the family silver and run with it. To do so, he set a fire as a distraction. All he actually managed to do was to knock himself out with the smoke, and so it was fairly about as incompetent a robbery as there's ever been. But it did give Supermarine the excuse that they've been looking for to say this is just not a tenable thing, and Lady Cooper was forced out.
At last, the Spitfire designers have the place to themselves, and the team can be expanded and refreshed.
I knew that I had skills that nobody else had, and therefore I was in a different category to the other girls.
Through the gates of Hursley Park cycles a very determined 18-year-old art student from Portsmouth by the name of Stella Broughton.
On my first day at Supermarine, I left home about 6 a.m. The cycle was some 30-odd miles. After having packed my bike with all I needed for the next week, I started to climb up Portsdown Hill, a climb of 6 in 1. Past Fort Widley, turned down Pigeon House Lane. For 3 miles, there was no need to pedal.
I was literally commandeered from working for the Navy to go and work on the Spitfire, because my skills were required and no one else had those particular skills.
There are plenty of young women working at Hursley Park, including the skilled tracers who turned the designers' drawings into finished design sheets. But Stella joins a vital section dominated by men.
The drawing office comprised some 200 draftsmen, and my appointment had caused some embarrassment at the fact I would be the first female of under 21 years to sit at a board. The tracers were of different ages, and some were rather dismissive of what they called pretty pictures.
We had to clock in and out every day. Then I'd go to my desk, and there I would join my colleagues, 3 draftsmen, who prepared the initial drawings for the assembly of parts of the aircraft. Those drawings were then given to me, and I had to do the master linen copy of these drawings for printing. These were then sent out and were put into crates which contained parts of the assembly of the aircraft.
I was told that the drawings I had been given to do were to be sent to North Africa. A motorcyclist was waiting at the gates to get them to London, where they would then be put into crates and sent to General Montgomery. My drawings will be inside these crates to show how to assemble the Spitfire parts.
Stella is determined to hold her own. Nothing will stop her producing the very finest work on the new Spitfire designs, even if that means appealing to the very top, the Minister of Aircraft Production himself.
At college, I was top in lettering, and it was the lettering skills which were very important to Supermarine, because all the written stuff on the masters had to be read by people who didn't really understand English. So it had to be very, very clear. Then I wanted a particular ruler, we called them scales in those days, with a beveled edge so that I could get accurate lines. I went to the shop in Portsmouth, I got the pens, but they couldn't supply me with a ruler. They just weren't available. So I went back to the firm, told my boss, and he told his boss, and he told the head of the firm. And the head of the firm obviously had words with Lord Beaverbrook, who was the person in the government at that time responsible for aircraft production. And within a week, I had a message from Lord Beaverbrook: go back to the shop in Portsmouth. I have arranged for one bevel-edged scale to be sent there, and that is to be sold to you and nobody else.
That's the spirit. Stella is a perfectionist, just like the father of the Spitfire himself. R.J. Mitchell was, and still is, regarded by many as one of the very greatest of aircraft designers. His influence guides the design team as they work frantically to produce a faster and feistier Spitfire.
The one outstanding and all-important requirement is speed. Every feature has to be sacrificed to this demand. The result of this is that every part of the aircraft just and only just fulfills its requirements.
R.J. Mitchell combined mechanical expertise with artistic flair and temperament. He was a pioneer of aircraft speed, taking over as chief designer at Supermarine in 1919 when he was just 24. In an interwar age obsessed by speed, glamour and elegance, he designed the world's fastest aircraft.
You can put your hand on this piece of Supermarine technology here and know that R.J. Mitchell himself saw this aircraft, touched this aircraft, worked on this aircraft and saw it win the Schneider Trophy, which I think is fantastic.
Andy Jones helps run the Solent Sky Museum in Southampton, home to a Spitfire F-24 and the plane that inspired it, a beautiful polished metal seaplane, a plane designed to win the Schneider Trophy, the competition for the fastest plane in the world.
By winning the third successive victory in 1931, the S6B won the Schneider Trophy outright for Great Britain. This machine later established a world speed record of over 407 miles per hour.
It's all built for speed, and you can see that in the design. Everything about it is streamlined, aerodynamics. When Mitchell designed this aircraft, he didn't sit down to design an aesthetically pleasing aircraft. They wanted something that was fast, and they had this understanding now of aerodynamics. So what they ended up doing was these wonderful lines, these wonderful curves, purely about mathematics and aerodynamics. And what they ended up doing was designing something which looks stunning. She's in this wonderful blue colour and also a lot of bare polished metal. But importantly about this, and this is the link between the Schneider Trophy and the Spitfire, is that what Mitchell and his team learnt about high-speed flight from the Schneider Trophy, they came out and they had the most developed design team, they had most knowledge of high-speed flight after the Schneider Trophy. And they took all that design work, they took all that knowledge that they'd learnt from the Schneider Trophy, and they then put it into the Spitfire.
Mitchell saw the Spitfire fly, but never saw it fight. He died of cancer in 1937.
There's a quote that was made by Geoffrey Quill, the test pilot. R.J. Mitchell's greatest achievement, apart from the plane itself, was in putting together the team that designed, modified and maintained the Spitfire at its height.
Mitchell's successors at Supermarine operate in a very different world. Glamour and elegance are an irrelevance. The Spitfire has to become a better killing machine than anything the Germans can develop.
That sort of consternation that was created really did drive all of these developments to try and get the Spitfire to be the top dog again. You know, crisis breeds necessity and necessity breeds efficiency. So really it was a case of trying to boost the Spitfire's flattering assets whilst reducing the errors that it had made in terms of trying to come up against the BF-109 and then, of course, the Focke-Wulf-190. As the Mark V Spitfire had been so quickly outclassed by the Focke-Wulf-190, the British knew that they really had to start making the necessary adaptations and developments in order to keep up with this frightening new fighter. So they started looking at increases in armament and in armour. They looked at its sort of centre of gravity by putting its radiators underneath each wing so it's a little bit more balanced out. It had improvements in visibility and in its horsepower of its engines.
At the outbreak of the war, the Spitfire Mark I had a top speed of 584 kilometres per hour. By the end of the war, the Spitfire was able to fly at 720 kilometres per hour and reach a flying altitude 3 kilometres higher.
The old Spitfire was pretty fast, This one's a lot faster, and it's certainly the answer to that Focke-Wulf 190 we've been hearing so much about.
The team at Horsley Park made this extraordinary speed of development possible. New, better designs could travel from the drawing board through mock-ups to full-size prototype aircraft, all on the one site that the Germans were never able to find and destroy.
So we're inside the stable yard here, just come through the stevedore archway. This was taken over along with parts of the house in 1940, and they actually erected a hangar over the top of the stable yard. So when you look in an aerial photograph, it's not immediately obvious that it's anything there. And it was here that test and research had most of their work. So a lot of the stress testing of alloys and so forth to make sure that they actually were capable of being used in the new planes or could cope with the new increased power of the engines. And this was where prototype work was done. So the archway we just come through, when they moved out of here and moved over to the experimental hangar where we're walking, they were carrying a Spitfire. They literally had to bring it out without the wings on, obviously. But that's, again, that's how you made planes.
Many versions of the Spitfire were born at Horsley House. Interceptors, ground attack aircraft, reconnaissance planes, the Seafire that could take off from aircraft carriers, and the Mark 9 that could match and beat the best the Germans had. As D-Day came and the Allied forces pushed through France, the Spitfire would be the master of the skies, destroying German fighters and supporting the bombers, ripping the heart out of the Nazi war effort. The Spitfire would be the only fighter aircraft built at the start of the war that was still being produced and sent into frontline action in 1945. It outlived all of its competitors.
I was very pleased that I was able to use my talents in such a way. It gives me a little bit of pleasure to know that I was one of the people who helped during the war to produce the plane which really saved this country.
In the next episode of Spitfire, the People's Plane, we take to the air and discover how it really felt to fly a Spitfire against a deadly foe.
Meet America's first black billionaire.
It took almost 200 years for the first African-American to attain $1 billion in net worth and wealth.
Hi there, I'm Ed Butler, presenter of the Business Daily podcast from the BBC World Service. That was the media magnate Bob Johnson telling me recently how much money he thinks should be paid to black Americans to compensate for the legacy of slavery.
The average net worth of a white household in the United States, $350,000. Multiply that number by 40 million descendants of slaves. That gets you to $14 trillion approximately.
It would be a bonanza. I mean, that's two-thirds of the current US GDP. It's a gigantic sum.
And it wouldn't be a bonanza. It would be damages owed to them.
Damages for slavery? Download the recent Business Daily podcast, Reparations for African Americans, to find out more. Business Daily. We're not just business, you know.